You're very welcome along to It's Not a Sport Podcast. It's episode 8 running, the final episode of season 1.
Yeah.
Tear running down my eye
emotional.
Right now.
It's been emotional.
We started this podcast as a sort of a way to give people who play these sports and play obscure sports a platform and a way to talk about why they love it. And I think we've actually got to know a good few facts and interesting things about different sports that we wouldn't have known going into it, for sure, anyway.
Like, the main benefit from our point of view was, as you said, to learn more about these sports. But what I've noticed since we've done it is that the appreciation from the people involved in the sports that we've covered, they've been very appreciative of us giving somewhat of an exposure to their sport. And then also the people who've actually been interested in learning, much like us, in these sports. So we've had a good reception in that regard. So it's been a positive experience, season one.
Yeah, I think the main thing I took from it was, like, a lot of the time you can kind of write off these sports as, you know, they're just obscure sports and nobody really cares about them, they're niche, but really there's actually some really interesting parts to all of them individually, and they're actually really difficult a lot of the time.
Yeah, and while our podcast gives you such a drastically different array of things as like free diving as compared to bowling or chess as we do today, so in that regard it's been so positive.
Yeah, and I just want to thank everyone who came into studio. So episode one, these episodes are all available on offtheball.com, on Spotify, iTunes, anywhere you can get your podcasts. Just go to the highlights section on offtheball.com. Episode one was Ultimate Frisbee. Chris Tinkler and Sarah Melvin came into studio.
Unbelievable.
Sarah Melvin, the week after we had her in, the women's national team went on to win a European championship. So I don't think either of us expected that.
I'm not saying we should take credit, but we should take a little bit of
I'm
credit.
Taking the credit. I don't care. Tenpin bowling, Jason Burns, national team representing us in bowling. Roller derby, we had the Gears in from Dublin Derby. And that was probably the most the most fun podcast we did this year, I think, or part of the season anyway. It was absolute chaos listening to them talk about a sport that I had no idea any of the rules, and they were trying to explain it to me. Free diving was probably one of the more poignant parts because It's such a dangerous sport, but Claire Walsh just loves it so much. Surfing, met Richie Fitzgerald, former big wave surfer up in Donegal, met him in Bundoran down at a surf shop. The godfather of skateboarding, Clive Rowan, came in to visit us, spoke about the different cultures within skateboarding, the time Tony Hawk came to visit Ireland, and really just kind of the underground world of skateboarding within Ireland, which was really cool. Our episode last week, episode 7, Cormac Comerford, he's fighting a good fight in winter sports for Ireland. Obviously, winter sports are really niche within Ireland, and he's just doing his best to try promote the sport and get up those rankings. He knows he's not going to win a medal. He'll represent Ireland at the Olympics, but he knows he's not going to come anywhere near a medal, but he's doing it just for the love of it. And this week, we've gone for chess, The main games of chess. Can you play chess?
I can play chess, not to the level of our guests, but we would have played it in school a little bit as it was one of the things we were encouraged to do. It was a way of getting out of class, basically. Yeah. So it was one of the things you were allowed to do, which was non-academic.
I think it says a lot for me as a person that I never learned how to play chess, but I know how to play draughts very well.
Yeah, well, they're kind of seen as like one's a step up from the other, but they are very different games entirely.
Like, God, yeah.
Chess, I don't think anyone ever taught us to play. We just kind of, you know, you learn
as you go. Yeah. I think the real misconception with chess is that, you know, it's something that only intelligent people do, and people who aren't maybe physically talented in different sports where, you know, like football or athletically gifted.
Yeah.
But that's just not the case, really. Like, there's just a lot of logic that goes into it. Mm. It's not really intelligence whether you can play chess or not.
And it's so digitized now. And one of the most interesting things about this interview is that the human element is still very much to the fore. Like, it's still mano a mano in many respects, and you're almost thinking about what your opponent's thinking as much as you are about what's on the board, which kind of obviously gets lost when you're playing against a computer.
Yeah, we didn't ask our guests about this when we came in, but it was something on my mind. It's really strange. It's the one sport that I can think of where a robot or a computer can do it to the exact same level, if not higher, than a human can at the minute.
It's depressing.
It's quite scary. Mm. And it's been doing that for years now. It's like, I'm pretty sure ever since I was on a computer, I remember chess being on it.
Yeah.
So you can only imagine if you can put it to that, once the kind of once the minds of robots improve, they're going to take over in football and rugby and all these different sports as well.
It's the ultimate compliment for the sport that, much like you hear in boxing as well, where the metaphors that are used in other sports, like they're up against the ropes now and this kind of stuff, you'll hear it in chess. Just listen out for this weekend, you'll hear at least one reference to if something's being played at a high level or there's tactical battles going on, like it will be alluded to. So it just shows the esteem it's held about in that regard from an intellectual point of view.
Yeah, and our guest this week is Alexander Babarin. He grew up in the old USSR, the Soviet Union, which is a really interesting aspect of his life and how he came to play chess as well. And also you have the whole Bobby Fischer versus USSR back in the 60s and 70s, which is something that we'll go into with Alex as well. But Alex is also the only grandmaster of chess in Ireland, so he is held to a very high esteem, and he also goes around and teaches chess in college, and also teaches the he's an Irish Olympiad as well, so he plays at the highest possible standard. So the last episode of season one of It's Not a Sport podcast, here is Alexander Babarin. Delighted to say I'm joined in studio now by Alex Babarin. Alex, thanks very much for joining us in the studio.
Thank you.
You're one of the only Irish grandmasters in chess at the minute. Are you the only one?
At the moment, I'm the only one, but that may not last very long because there are a few guys who may get this title soon enough, I hope.
And just so the viewers at home or their listeners at home are aware of it, what would be the difference between a grandmaster, a normal player, and there's also an international master as well?
Grandmaster is the highest title you can attain in chess. There are various criteria in place, so kind of it's awarded by International Chess Federation. So basically you need to have a rating of certain level, 2,500 minimum. You need to have probably three good results in kind of certified tournaments. So it's a bit too technical, but basically you need to be pretty good.
Okay.
To become a grandmaster. The title was invented around 100 years ago by Russian Tsar, believe it or not. So it's kind of a coincidence. He called players competing at the tournament in St. Petersburg at the time, I think it was 1914, not just great chess masters, but grandmasters of chess. So by doing that, he invented the title for those players and those players only. For a while, you needed to win two tournaments of international importance to get that title, because winning one can be a fluke.
Yeah.
And then I think it was sometime in the 50s when International Chess Federation actually, you know, stepped in and established kind of rules and things like this. So the number of grandmasters used to be very small. We had an explosion in recent maybe decade or two, but nonetheless it's probably about 1500 grandmasters in the world. Okay. That's not that high a number.
And is that because there's more people playing chess, or is that because it's becoming easier to become a grandmaster?
A bit of both. There are definitely a lot more people playing chess, and there are more opportunities. And in addition, the International Chess Federation kind of relaxed some of the rules a little bit to accommodate, you know, the appearance of more grandmasters that way.
And I just want to talk a bit about your background in chess and how you became an Irish a grandmaster in chess. So you were born in Russia originally and then moved to Ireland later on in life?
Yes, it was 1993. I was competing in a tournament in France. And over breakfast, I wanted to practice my English. And my the guy who was sharing the table with me happened to be an Irishman. His name is Eamon Keown. And we started chatting. And Eamon had this idea of bringing someone from the former Soviet Union to work in Ireland for a year. So we kept chatting. And a few weeks later, he invited me to play in a tournament in Dublin just to have a look. And later that year, I actually moved here with my wife and my then three-year-old son. So that's how it started. And 26 years later, I'm still here. And I actually became grandmaster while living in Ireland, because at the time I was international master, which is one grade below grandmaster.
Okay. And I actually said that you were born in Russia, but at the time it would have been the USSR.
It would be, yeah. Well,
so, and they put a big emphasis on chess during that period as well. So what was it like growing up in the USSR and learning to play chess in that environment?
I think when I kind of grew up, it was already maybe past the golden era of Soviet chess, in a sense, because it all started in the 20s. When chess was kind of used as one of many means to educate the masses. There was a huge movement of peasants to the cities. They need to be entertained, they need to be educated. So there were lots of different clubs set up for them, you know, lots of sports clubs. And chess was seen, quite rightly, I think, as a kind of good way to do something. Also, it was quite a cheap way to, you know, get people involved in some activities. Just basically to kind of to keep them busy and, you know, keep them entertained and interested in something. So the golden era was probably up to the 60s. And when I learned, I was started playing chess in the 70s, it was probably the end of it. But I heard from some of my friends that in the 60s, being a grandmaster in the USSR was like being a rock star or footballer. You know, people would recognize you in the streets and things like this. So I've seen some evidence of that, like in books, in movies and stuff like this. But when I grew up, it was already kind of coming down. So nowadays, it's just one of many activities you can do.
What age were you when you first learned how to play chess? I think your father taught you, did he?
Yeah, my dad taught me the game. I think I was probably 7 at the time, give or take a year. It kind of suited me because I learned chess. I very quickly got a book or two, and this was the activity I could do on my own. My parents worked. There was no babysitter. There was an elderly relative kind of looking after me, so chess was a kind of a godsend for me because I could spend a lot of time just playing through games from those books, and I loved it.
What drew you to the game of chess? Was it that isolation that you could kind of learn this trade yourself?
That contributed, that it could be kind of a solitary, you know, activity in a way. I think I was pretty competitive. I mean, there is an image of chess that it's kind of a game for kind of lowness, and but that's actually not true. If you look at sort of strong players, they usually engage in other sports, and they are usually very competitive and driven. So I like that, the fact that you know, you play yourself, you have no one to blame. I did other sports throughout my life, but chess kind of remained one passion I kind of kept.
And
throughout.
At that stage of your life, were you aware of the mental aspect of the game and the concentration that it takes to be competitive at a high level?
Yeah, you kind of learn it very quickly that in order to succeed, you need to stay focused, because you can be playing a game for 3-4 hours, and just one silly mistake can just ruin all that work. And a very good game can be ruined just in a second. So you learn it quickly enough, yeah.
And in that case, what kind of personalities do you think draws in chess? Is there a certain personality, or is it, like you said, a stereotype that it would be the more loners? Like, I suppose one of the key aspects of chess that people would look in from the outside in would be you have to be an intelligent person. Do you have to be intelligent or logical?
That's a very good question. You know, I like to quote Bernard Shaw, who half jokingly, I suppose, said that the ability to play great chess is no sign of great intelligence. It's a sign of great intelligence gone the wrong way. So I kind of like it. I don't think, I mean, I saw in my life really intelligent people who really wanted to be good at chess, and they couldn't. I mean, just didn't have what it takes. It's hard to define what chess talent is, but there is certainly such a thing. And then again, I saw some people I did not think highly of, and they were extremely good at chess. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. Yes, definitely you will find that, you know, among chess players, there is a high percentage of highly intelligent people. But is it because chess helps them to become more intelligent, or is it because they are driven to the game? Typically, it's somebody who plays chess at serious level. That would be a person, kind of a bit of a perfectionist, somebody who hates losing, and somebody who can be very methodical and kind of, you know, has the self-discipline. That would be the qualities, I guess.
So how long would you spend a day playing chess to get to that level? Is it the same as any professional aspect in life, that if you put the time in, that you'll eventually get better at the game and get to that level? Or are there certain people where they're just, they know the chessboard and they know what they're going to do?
Yeah, well, like I said, there is this thing about talent. I mean, some people just get it much quicker, much faster than others. So you can see that even in a child, you can see how quickly they can get a grasp on kind of ideas and things like this. So it's possible to say, well, this child, for example, seems to be very talented. You can say that, but then you cannot say that child will be a great player, because talent is just one aspect. Hard work is another, and you need to put in hours. There is no easy way to say, like, you've got to study 5 hours a day. And if somebody says that, they're typically lying, they're just making it up. All players, they spend time as they see fit. You know, when I was a teenager, I could be spending like 8 hours on some days. I could be doing absolutely nothing to do with chess on other days. So it's kind of normal.
Yeah, and that kind of leads on to my next question, because I was just listening to a podcast that had Nakamura, the Blitz player, that was speaking about it, and he was talking about Magnus Carlsen, and a lot of the time that Magnus Carlsen spends training for chess isn't with a chessboard, is with his mind. And I was just wondering, would you have experienced that yourself, whereby you're not necessarily practicing with a chessboard, you're practicing in your head off the best possible way to go about winning a game?
Well, I think chess players often think about, you know, positions in their heads. But I think, you know, having a chessboard would greatly assist. So I would imagine Magnus thinks about chess probably all the time. But I think he has the hours when he kind of, you know, walks in a more kind of focused way. But that doesn't mean that he cannot come up with some idea when he's playing soccer or, you know, basketball or something like this, or going for walks. Yeah, it's possible, but typically you get more when you sit at the chessboard, and nowadays it's probably more like a computer screen than a chessboard, because it's just much faster.
So you mentioned that, you know, sometimes there's a kid out there that you can see has natural born talent, but a lot of it is practice as well, and I suppose the person that springs to mind for that is Bobby Fischer, who is a kid protege and was a grandmaster, youngest grandmaster at the age of 15. So he would have been doing his stuff you probably would have been a little bit young at that stage, but would you have been aware of Bobby Fischer and who he was when you were growing up, when you were watching people play chess?
Yeah, of course. When I started taking chess quite seriously, I quickly learned that there was this famous chess player, American player. There was a kind of aura about him, that he was kind of a lonely grandmaster from the West and fighting against sort of lots of strong, incredibly strong Russian players. Yeah, I studied his games. He certainly was quite scientific in his approach to the game. He like studied it and, you know, brought it in many ways to a new level. Yeah. Nowadays, I'd say many people kind of do it the way he did it, or maybe even more intensely, without even thinking about that. So,
and I suppose most of the stuff that we would have heard about Bobby Fischer would have been from a Western perspective, and I just wanted to find out if there would have been a perspective on Bobby Fischer from the USSR, and how he would have been perceived, because it was before the match against Spassky in Reykjavik. He was saying quite a bit about Russians in general, Russian the hospitality, the people. And I was just wondering, was there a way that he was perceived within USSR at the time?
I think the chess players greatly admired him for his talent, for the way he played. Authorities certainly tended to paint him rather negatively. There would be sort of references to his kind of outrageous behavior, that he would pull out of tournaments, that he would come up with demands. There would be sometimes insinuations that he wasn't very intelligent, things like this, you know. But I think most people kind of dismissed it because he was first of all, he was a great chess player, a genius, and that people respected him for that.
And apart from his fatal flaw of his mental issues in going forward and later on into his life as well, and some of the things he said may not have been agreeable at the time or even now, purely from a chess perspective, is he the greatest player of all time?
Well, I mean, his mental problems started much later, after 1972. But looking back, and I know it's kind of a common argument, a common question, who is the greatest player of all times? And I can see if you ask this question in the West, particularly in the United States, they would say Bobby Fischer. I mean, maybe not so much in Europe, maybe. But I personally think Garry Kasparov had the biggest influence on the game. So to me, he's the greatest player of all time. Now people start talking about Magnus Carlsen, who is still quite young, but maybe he will be the greatest player, you know, ever.
And what?
Just in the broader sporting realm. So, if sports played at a high level, chess is almost used as a metaphor. Like it's like this is like a chess match where it's been the strategy is at some sort of level. Are there any sports where you look at and see where the strategy might be similar, or you appreciate where there's high level thinking going on?
Well, I mean, I used to play a bit of basketball myself, so I can see in basketball you have to kind of use various strategies. So obviously, most team sports you have to kind of use strategies and adjust them, anticipating strategies of your opponent and how they will perceive you. So there is like this kind of, you know, double level when you have to think what you're going to do, what they will do, and what they may think you will be doing, you know, this kind of thing. So that's typical for many sports, I'd say. So yeah, you know, you basically try to win, and you try to plan ahead and anticipate what the other person will do.
And the psychological element of it is so interesting, because how much of it is the move you make on the chessboard is more to like maybe upset your opponent's rhythm more than what you actually want to achieve in that move, if you don't understand what I mean?
There are two radically different kind of opposed approaches to chess. For example, some people say that I play with chess pieces. I don't mind the opponent. Most players, nonetheless, kind of think that opponent is an important part of the game, and psychology is an important part of the game, that you don't just play against sort of, you know, computer or kind of just pure mind. You play against humans. They have emotions, fears. You can kind of use it to your advantage sometimes. I would be in the latter camp, that I would be thinking about my opponent quite a lot, and I would be thinking also what they think of me. And had numerous examples when it helped. I remember I was playing one game somewhere in Spain, and my opponent was a club player, what we call a club player, so I never heard of him. And he was quite a bit older than me. I was probably in my late 20s, and he was probably, could be early 50s. And I was much higher rated, but there was a situation where it seems that he was going to attack me. And with every move, it looked like as he was getting very excited about the game and everything. And then I just thought, I don't like the way it's going. So I threw something in the works and like sacrificed something, which was rather speculative. Mm. But he had to defend. And I could see that he didn't like it. And as if somebody like turn off the light, and he lost interest, and he lost very quickly. So who knows, had I played my sort of normal chess, he would have continued his attack and might have won the game. But because it was a change, it was so quick and not to his liking, it certainly affected his play. So there are numerous examples of that, you know, in chess practice, pretty much in every tournament for most players.
And you mentioned the word emotion. Like, I know it's such a calculative game. So in an ideal world, is there an absence of emotion where you're just playing?
Oh, you cannot avoid emotion. Emotion is just part of the game. It's you get excited. And it doesn't happen too often, the best kind of condition when I actually forget about who is playing against me. I just get sort of really into the game, and I just really want to do my best, and that doesn't happen too often, and that's hard to achieve perhaps. But emotions are everywhere before the game. It starts before the game, okay? For example, when you play in a tournament, you normally know the pairing the previous day. I have a habit that I don't want to know, because I know that mind will be playing tricks. I can be thinking about my next game while I should be asleep and things like this. I don't want to know this. Emotions, when you play the game, you think you're winning. It can affect your thinking greatly, that you can be, you may think that that's over. And this is the moment when you're actually very vulnerable to making some stupid mistakes. It comes with experience. I see that with juniors a lot. I used to be like that myself. So that's definitely one of the cases. And you get your pulse racing and things like this. I remember there was one game I was chasing that Grandmaster title. I had two Grandmaster gnomes, but the third one, the final one, proved to be quite elusive. And I needed to win one game, and if had I won that game, that would be it. And it was a very complex game, but both of us were short of time. But at some stage, I could feel that my pulse was just racing, and I nearly fainted. So I sat at the board, and I thought to myself, okay, you know, whatever it is, I'm going to take a few seconds. I'm not going to, you know, have a heart attack over a game of chess. It's important, but I'm not going to do this. So the game was drawn. I didn't get that. No, my God, it eventually. But, you know, I avoided probably some problems. So, yeah, emotions are playing a big part.
Can you walk us through what it's like to play at a tournament of chess? Because a lot of the talk is, how do you make chess a spectator sport? But is it more difficult to play in that kind of scenario where there are actual spectators? And is it harder to concentrate on the game that way?
I don't think spectators would actually bother chess players in any way. Of course, nowadays it's not a spectator sport, it's quite clear. Back in the Soviet Union, there would be hundreds of people watching games, and sometimes they wouldn't have enough room in the kind of in the hall. And they would put a demo board outside in the streets so people could see. You really need to have a little bit of a hype to do this. You also need to have people who would be competent enough to understand what's going on, and also kind of have interest in the game. So it's all about personalities. Nowadays, it's very difficult to make chess a spectator sport. It's hugely popular online, so people like watch games online. There were different sort of kind of numbers which popped up. Sometimes it could be hundreds of thousands of people watching a particular tournament. It could be maybe as much as a million, but it's not a spectator sport. So. As for your question about concentration, I don't think it would affect, because for chess player, most stuff is going up in the mind. So, okay. You know, so we're used to distractions. So.
And one of the things I want to get into is the importance of time within the game of chess, because you don't have unlimited time to play each move and play each game. But before we do that, we have to run through the different types of chess, because the time will vary on which type of chess you're playing. So could you just explain the difference between classical chess, which is played at tournaments, blitz and bullet, and I think there's Armageddon coming through now as well?
Yeah, okay. That's easy enough. Well, the chess clock was invented probably about 200 years ago, okay? And the idea was that back then people could play for hours, and they could game could be unfinished at like 3 a.m. because somebody is just taking forever, and you have no way of forcing a person to make a move.
Yeah.
So the invention of chess clock was a great thing for the game. Classical game is kind of slow time control, probably like the maximum which is allowed at the time. And even that has changed over the years. For example, when I was, say, teenager, kind of classical time control would be probably 6, could be 7 hour session, after which a game could be adjourned and play could be resumed at, you know, after a day or two,
yeah.
Okay? So nowadays, classical is probably, you're talking more like 5 hours max, no adjournments, because it has to be decided on the day, okay, in one sitting, one session, because of computers and everything else. So even the definition of classical has changed. So what we call classical wouldn't be called that, you know, say 30 years ago. Blitz is speed chess, where you have 5 minutes per game or about that. Sometimes you may get 3 minutes each plus 2 seconds increment for every move you make, which is kind of became possible when electronic clocks became available. So you can just have this option, which is hugely popular. So what used to be 5 minutes per game each is now usually replaced like 3 minutes plus 2 seconds, which gives plenty of time to play a decent game,
yeah,
for most players. Bullet is, in my opinion, the crazy form of chess where you get 60 seconds per game each, no increment.
Yeah.
And it's all really down to reflexes. But there are people who are absolutely mad about this, and you know, they play a lot of time on bullet. You come up with strategies. You've got to surprise. So basically, the person who surprised his opponent first has a huge advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to be very fast. I personally don't play that, but I can understand that some people like it, and I can understand why. Armageddon is the term which describes a game when you have a competition between two players, and this is like, say, it's a tie and they have to break it, and they play, after classical games, they play rapid chess games when you get typically, say, 25 minutes each.
Yeah.
And then they play blitz games. But if those games don't produce a result, and that's possible, this Armageddon game becomes a reality in which usually white would get 6 minutes, black will get 5. But black gets the draws. So black is okay to draw the game, and that wins the match, okay?
Yeah.
And white has to win.
Okay.
So curiously enough, most people in this situation take white because white has small advantage and extra time, and they know that there is no coming back, so they just kind of feel it's easier to play that way.
Yeah, and the reason I asked was because the podcast that I was listening to with Hikaru Nakamura, he said that with unlimited time, no, he doesn't feel that he would lose to a human in a classical game of chess if he had unlimited time to make every move. But he's also one of the best at bullet. So he feels that bullet suits him better just because of the way his mind works, and Magnus Carlsen is suited better to the likes of classical because he takes his time making up his decision. And I was just wondering, do you think the different personalities or the different approaches to the game varies for the different types of brains that are going to these games?
Yeah, well, you can say that there are some people who like to think a little bit more, and there are people who are just faster. But my experience shows that if you look back at history of chess, those who were the world champions at the time, those were typically the best blitz players as well, you know,
yeah,
overall. Even if we look at Nakamura and Magnus, that is also fair to say that Magnus, he is a better player overall.
Yeah,
and he is a better blitz player. Nakamura has kind of a lot of fame playing online, and he's a great blitz player, but he's not stronger than Magnus. He's actually weaker, and Magnus won like world championships in blitz and things like this. So it's probably to do more to do with personality. Some people kind of like this instant gratification. They like playing Blitz, more games in given time, and Nakamura is probably one of them. And some people kind of, they don't mind being a little bit slow, or they kind of appreciate different aspects, but they can be great Blitz players too, and that would be Magnus.
Yeah, and you mentioned the a lot of the chess is played online these days as well. So how big of an impact did that have when technology started to come in? Because you can program a computer to do what you
Yeah, well, I don't really play Blitz online myself, because I rarely played Blitz in the first place. I mean, I would play it occasionally with friends just to pass time, to kind of, you know, for fun. But some people are quite obsessed about their chess online, and they take it very seriously. And unfortunately, that also means that sometimes they can be cheating. They can be playing with assistants of computer programs and things like this. What's the idea? It's hard to understand, really, because they must know that they're cheating, and mm-hmm. whatever they achieve is not their making. So chess servers or places where you can play on chess online, they obviously try to fight with that. They have various ways of doing this. Basically, it means that you can play for fun, but when internet and chess kind of merged, there were a lot of talks that there would be official tournaments with prizes and things like this. But that actually hasn't happened, you know, to a large extent, because of the possibility of someone using assistance. Yeah. I mean, it's very hard to control.
Have you experienced cheating in real life setting?
In real life, no, I wouldn't say. I mean, no, I don't think I have experienced in real life that, you know, I experienced lots of times that my opponents played much better chess than me. but that's not because they were getting any assistance. No, I was fortunate in that sense. But I heard of stories. A good friend of mine was actually victim of the first recorded incident of cheating in chess. He is a strong player, grandmaster, and he was playing a guy in a tournament somewhere in Germany whom he never heard of before. And he was completely destroyed in the game, and when he gave up, his opponent said, "Yeah, it's about time, it's checkmate in 8 moves. And this is something which kind of really puzzled him, because a good player can see a checkmate in 2 coming, checkmate in 3 maybe. Yeah. Checkmate in 4 is already kind of doubtful, but no one can say, well, it's checkmate in 8. So he came home and he set up the position on the board, ran a chess program. Sure enough, it immediately told him it's checkmate in 8. So he made a complaint. He said this is something fishy going on, the way he played the game, his comments after the game. So there was an investigation. They actually kind of got a warrant, searched his apartment, German police. They found some sophisticated equipment he bought. So he was definitely cheating. He was using kind of a telephone signal or something. So there must be an accomplice or something. So I don't think there was any kind of prosecution, because I don't think they, you know, judges would like to put people behind bars for cheating in the game of chess. But that was the first case, and since then there were quite a few more, unfortunately. But it's a program, a big problem in chess. But I think currently International Chess Federation is beginning to kind of take measures and sort of get a handle on the situation.
And playing tournaments away from home, like you see it in other sports where people playing at home have an advantage just by dint of playing at home, are there environmental factors you have to take into account at all, or is a chessboard just a chessboard when it comes down to it?
You should consider these factors, because playing at home in chess may not always be of advantage, okay? Because when you go away and you play, you get less of a distraction. When I remember when I was a teenager or a young man playing in my home was sometimes difficult because you get distractions, you meet your friends, you know, sort of, it's kind of hard to separate your day-to-day life with what you're doing, like in the tournaments. You don't want to kind of completely withdraw from people around you, but in a way, you need to kind of concentrate and focus. So it's easier to do when you're away, like in a hotel, not too many distractions. You get your tournament going, you get your computer, you get a few books, you know, but you may not interact that much. So from that point of view, it can be actually more challenging to play in at home. Unlike, say, in soccer, where you get like the spectators, the cheering, you know, in chess it doesn't work. It wouldn't be of any assistance, really.
Before we finish up, I just wanted to get your opinion on one thing, because I know you go around schools and you teach people how to play chess, and you do it at college as well. And a couple of years ago, Armenia made chess compulsory for children of the age of 7 up in schools. I was just wondering what you thought of that. Is that a good idea, or is that something that maybe you shouldn't push the sport onto them?
Yeah, Armenia is the only country in the world where chess is part of the national school curriculum. Russia is introducing chess in some schools as a kind of a pilot program. Personally, I'm not sure that this is such a good idea, because there are obvious problems. I mean, some people would love to play chess in the school. Some people will be absolutely cold to the game. I'm not really sure why we need to kind of force it on them. It's always a problem to find people who can teach the game. If you take chess players, they need to be taught how to interact with kids, and there are lots of practical issues. If you take teachers, you need to bring him to a certain level of competence in chess. Mm-hmm. So you get kind of problems with staff, with training, you know, it's not that easy. I'm sure there are many benefits. I think one of the Armenians officials at the time said that the reason they were doing it, they noticed that kids who did chess didn't do drugs. So he said that's something we want to kind of reinforce, this idea that people kind of have this thinking, forward thinking, mm-hmm. planning, things like this. So I think I'm not sure whether this will succeed in many countries, this idea, whether that will be implemented and whether it will be successful. Armenians seem to be doing all right with that, but it's a small enough country with huge kind of chess culture and population. So elsewhere, chess is very popular in schools, in Ireland, as well as everywhere else, really.
Yeah, and I was just reading that from 2015, a recent study back in 2018 showed that between 2015 and 2018, there was a 50% increase in the amount of people that have signed on to the chess union within Ireland. Mm-hmm. So is chess a growing sport within Ireland itself?
Yes, definitely. It's largely due to new players, like these juniors who start in schools, and some of them get very interested. They kind of get hooked on chess. They want to play tournaments not just against other kids in the school or in from other schools. They start playing against adults, and there are quite a few tournaments. And then they start taking it more and more seriously. They join the Irish Chess Union, and we see it in the numbers. Okay, for example, we have probably about 10 tournaments throughout the year, which are, you know, of real significance. And one of them is Gonzaga Classic, which is a tournament usually held in January. And I remember a few years back, it was a, you know, medium-sized tournament, maybe just over 100 people. I think now it's just well over 200 people. And the vast part of that increase is due to young players who didn't play chess a few years back, then now they're playing, and they're just making a huge impact on the scene. Yeah.
Can you see another Irish Grandmaster coming up anytime soon? Who would be the protege?
Well, the situation is rather simple. We have Sam Collins, a former student of mine, who has three Grandmaster norms. All Sam needs is to bring his rating to 2,500. We have Alex Lopez from Cork, who I believe has one Grandmaster norm, but he is very active. He plays quite a lot, so he can achieve the other two rather quickly. We also have a chess player who kind of disappeared from the scene, sadly, Brian Kelly. He works in Hong Kong, and I think he kind of focuses on his professional career. He actually has like three Grandmaster norms too. But young players are catching up. So the likes of Sam and Alex need to hurry up. We have a lot of really talented young players who within a year or two maybe beginning to get norms and get closer, you know, rating wise to at least IM or maybe beyond. So the competition is heating up. So it will be quite interesting to see what the national team will look like in, say, 3 years' time. I think my place on the team is pretty safe for the next Chess Olympiad, but I'm not too sure about the one in 3 years' time.
Well, hopefully we get to see a couple of Irish Grandmasters coming up soon as well. Alex, thanks very much for coming in and chatting to us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was
my
great.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Down, it's the upbeat, make it complete. So what's the story? Guaranteed accuracy, enhanced CD. Latest technology, darts at treble 20. Huge non-recoupable advance, majors be vigilant. I excel in both content and deliverance. So let's put on our classics and we'll have a little dance, shall we? No sales pitch, no media hype. No hydro, it's nice and ripe. I speak in communications in bold type. This ain't your archetypal street sound. Scan for ultrasounds, north, south, east, west and all round. And then to the underground.
You say that everything sounds the same. Then you go by them. There's no excuses, my friend. Let's push things forward. You say that everything sounds the same. Then you go by them. There's no excuses, my friend. Let's push things forward.